Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson.
Good evening, everybody. We're still catching our breath. The field is set for the Indianapolis 500. Qualifications are complete. Very hard to keep up with the activity today, but there was plenty of activity. Anyway, we're going to be here for the next hour. We'll be here until 7:15 this evening, taking your questions of a nostalgic nature about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. The number to call is 239-1070. That's 239-1070. And in fact, we already have Jim hanging on. So, Jim, thanks for calling. What can we help you with this evening?
Well, thanks for taking my call, Donald. I saw my first race in 1937 when Wilbur Shaw won it with the old Gilmore Special, kind of the scoop-nose-looking car.
Yeah.
And that was my first race. But anyway, today's field, looking at that, with Caston Evans at 224.86, and the other car that qualified, the last car, 224.5, I know that's not the fastest field that we've ever had, but it probably is the closest, isn't it?
Well, in terms of separation in miles an hour from fastest to slowest, no, because there were a couple of years when we were still running roadsters in 1958 and 1963 were both very close, and one of those was like 2.5 miles per hour difference, and the other, I think, was 2.7. But anyway, it's between, as I recall, between 58 and 1963. Those 2 years were exceptionally close in terms of miles an hour. But you're talking 145 down to, 142 or whatever. As the speeds get faster, then the closeness of the field is determined by the elapsed time rather than the speed. So although we've got 4 miles an hour, I don't know if we can do the elapsed times from fastest to slowest, but it's only about, just about 4 seconds or something like that to cover the entire field. I know that as of this morning when I came in, I think there was 5 seconds from fastest to slowest over the four-lap run. But we've had a couple of fields that were just within a couple of seconds with the 33 in terms of elapsed time, but in terms of speed, no, this would not be. It's 4 miles an hour, which is pretty close, and so I'll guess we'll have to do a little research, and maybe tomorrow night on the Talk of Gasoline Alley, we can give you a more definitive answer. But anyway, thanks. I'm sorry that's the best that we can do with that one. Let's go back to the phones, and Jeff.
Yes, hello, Donald.
Yes, sir.
What a beautiful day to be alive and living in central Indiana. We are just leaving the Winchester Speedway.
Oh, yeah.
Yep, and I'd like to know a little bit about Smokey Unick's legacy there at the Speedway, especially the car that Johnny Boyd drove, the sidecar. And I'm going to hang up and listen to you, okay?
Okay, you're thinking of Bobby Johns, I think, with the
Bobby
sidecar.
Johns.
Yeah.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
All right, Smokey Unick's tenure at the Speedway was from 1958 to 1975 was the last time that he entered a car. He didn't have a car every year, but anyway, in 1958 he ran a roadster, an Offie, that was driven by Paul Goldsmith, and it was out in the first lap accident. In 1959 he had a car called Smokey's Reverse Torque Special, which was one of the Racing Associates cars from the year before. The engine actually ran backwards because Smokey had this theory where if you ran the engine in the opposite direction, that the torque would go over to the right side instead of all the cars at that time apparently were running to the left side. And I don't quite understand what that means, but somebody told me that one time. But anyway, Dwayne Carter drove the car to seventh. In 1960, he did not enter a car. He was on the winning crew. He claimed he was the chief mechanic. He wasn't. He was on the crew and did the refuelings. Chickie Hiroshima was the chief mechanic, and that's well documented, and Jim Rathman won the race. All right, the following year, Smokey was the chief mechanic, and it was the 60 winning car, but it was painted black and gold. It had been a powder blue the year before, and Jim Rathman led a few laps early stages, but dropped out. In 62, Smokey had the 60 winning car was back again, and also a car that he had built which Kenny Rich and Paul Lacey were the car owners. It was called Ken Paul Incorporated. And Rathman preferred the older car, which he qualified and finished ninth. And the story is that when he showed up with this new car, that it was tentatively going to be owned by Kenny Rich and Paul Lacey. But they said, if it works out, we'll take it into our stable. And when it didn't work out, they said, Smokey, I think you just bought yourself a race car. So anyway, he came back with it in 63. It was called the Fiberglass Special, and Curtis Turner was the driver. He passed his rookie test, did not make a qualifying attempt with the car. In fact, he did crash it on one of the qualifying days in a practice. No, he did not. Never mind. He did not. I was confused with something else. Anyway, he did pass the test. The car never went to the qualifying line. In 64, Smokey came back with the famous sidecar, the Hurst Floor Shift Special, and Bobby Johns was given the call. It was entered with no driver, and it had an offie engine. Smokey said that he planned for that to be a turbine originally, but I don't want to stir all that up. It never had a turbine in it. It showed up with the offie. Dwayne Carter got it up over 150 miles an hour. Bobby Johns went out to make a qualifying run, and actually he did wave off on had a run with, I think, a couple of laps at like 147, which wouldn't have been fast enough to get in, but it wasn't that far off. He went out to make a qualifying attempt on the last day, but he hit the wall before taking the green flag, and that wrecked the car. And typical Smokey, rather like Mickey Thompson, he tried these experiments, but he'd only try them once. So in 65, Smokey didn't have a car. In 67 is the next time that he was back, and he had an Eagle, which Dennis Holm drove, and finished fourth and won Rookie of the Year. And then in 68, Smokey didn't enter. In 69, he had a 69 Eagle. There was only four of those cars built. Gurney had the three. Smokey got the other one. And as with the 67 Eagle, he changed it quite a bit. Joe Leonard was the driver. Joe got up to second at one point, had mechanical problems, long pit stop. A lot of other people had the same problem, and Joe was running at the end. I think he had 193 laps in, but it was enough to finish sixth. And then 70-71, Smokey didn't enter. In 72, he entered a car with a dual turbocharged Chevy engine, which never arrived. David Hobbs was going to be the driver, but it was a no-show. It did come in 73. Jerry Carl was the driver. Long story short, it finished 26th. There's a little anecdote there, but I won't go into that now. But it did finish in 26th place. In 74, Sam Sessions was the driver. Story we were told, I think, last night, which, and again, I won't go into all the details. The end result is that the gun went off at 6 o'clock on the last day. Several cars were left in line. Sam Sessions in the Smokey Unix Chevy was the next one up. 75 was the final year. Jerry Carl was back in again. The race was stopped at 174 laps because of was given 13th position. Anyway, that's Smokey Unick's career at the Indianapolis Speedway. And do we want to go just keep on going here? Do we need to take a break? All right, we're going to go to the phones. And, Derek, you're up next.
Hey, Donald, thank you for taking my call.
All right, thanks for calling.
Appreciate it. Last week you were talking about most memorable, or somebody had asked about most memorable Victory Lane celebrations, and it got me thinking about Emerson Fittipaldi and the orange juice situation. I was wondering if maybe you could give us a little insight on what you know. I know that happened a long time ago, and it's a pretty popular deal with fans of the 500, but I wonder if you could maybe talk about that a little bit, and maybe if MO had something waiting in a cooler for him, or if they had to go get this. Because if I recall, I think it was actually in a bottle that looked very familiar to the milk bottle. But, that was a long time ago. So I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit, and I'll hang up and listen to what you have to say.
It was long time ago, but honestly, we prefer to go back to longer ago than that. And when we were discussing memorable victory lanes, I think we meant in terms of emotional victory lanes. And that was emotional, but it was the crowd that was emotional, not the victory lane. If we have to go into that, which I really would rather not do. Fittipaldi was offered the milk, as has every winner since 1956 continuously, and I say offered the milk. It started in 36, but there was a few years where they didn't do it, but since 56 that's been a tradition. He was handed the milk, and he refused the milk because he had a bottle of orange juice. And he has had an arrangement, may still have, with the Brazilian government for growing oranges. They got huge orange groves, and they grow oranges for the government to make orange juice. And when he said, when he was asked over the public address, and I've got a theory about that whole thing, which I'm not going to do here. Maybe one of these days I'll do a different kind of a radio show. But let's just say that the fellow that was doing the public address made a point. In fact, he stressed twice, you're not going to drink the milk. And Fittipaldi, who was apparently a friend of this fellow, he wasn't doing him any favors, because when Fittipaldi said, no, you know, I drink orange juice, or we produce orange juice, or something like that, the crowd just came unglued. And I remember my head was down. I was in the booth, in the network broadcast booth, and doing some stats, had the headset on. And when I heard that, I mean, it was, I wouldn't say it was like I was stabbed in the stomach, but I did have that feeling that it just was a horrible feel. And but it wasn't just me. It was thousands and thousands of people. I don't know how many were listening, but probably 250,000, 300,000 or more on the grounds, and there was this instant booing. It wasn't something that developed over a few days or weeks or months. It was instantaneous. And Fittipaldi, up to that point, I mean, I think he realized, maybe not immediately, that he'd made a horrible error, because eventually he did agree to hold the bottle to his lips, but that's only after quite a bit of encouragement from Tony George and Roger Penske and others. There were several attempts to get him to do it, but he was pretty adamant that he wasn't going to, and then he very reluctantly held the bottle to his lips when his car owner mouthed to him, drink the milk. And you can see that on film. But anyway, Fittipaldi, I would say, was probably one of the most, he was one of the most popular drivers at the track. And it just seemed that just changed everything. And then he went from being one of the most popular drivers at the track to just being booed. And it never, I don't think he ever recovered from that. It was just a great, interesting piece of psychology, that something that would seem to be so insignificant about what you drink in Victory Lane, you know, why would that be important? Well, it's very important, and I remember thinking that was a good lesson, and I don't know that that lesson's ever been learned. When you've got a tradition, don't mess with the tradition, because there was a driver who was so popular, and then it's just like his career went down the drain in 5 seconds. So, don't mess with tradition. If you've got one that's working for you, leave it alone. Anyway, we really don't care to do those kind of questions. We'd rather do rainbows and bunnies, and I like that. I understand what that means. I just like to do the happy anecdotes and pay tribute to the great drivers of the past, and also the lesser lights that tried to break their way in. All right, we need to take a break right here. We will be here until 7:15, taking your calls on the Talk of Gasoline Alley. The number to call is 239-1070. That's 239-1070. We would rather do historical retrospectives rather than do opinions, but we can't really back down from a question unless we're running tight on time. Anyway, 239-1070 is the number to call, 239-1070. You're listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. We'll be right back after this. We're back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Find. 1070 The Fan. And before we get to the next caller, let's just do the Inspire Indy Fun Fact Challenge. Answer the following fun fact correctly, and you could win tickets to Community Day, the IPL 500 Festival Parade, and be qualified for the race weekend grand prize, which is a two-night stay at the Omni Severin Hotel, downtown Indianapolis. Also, restaurant vouchers for downtown Indianapolis, and two tickets to the 500-mile race, courtesy of Indianapolis Downtown Incorporated. Today's fun fact challenge is, who referred to the Indianapolis 500, or who first referred to the Indianapolis 500 as the greatest spectacle in racing? The interpretation of that is, who coined the phrase on the air as calling the Indianapolis 500 the greatest spectacle in racing? All right, don't call us. To play today's Inspire Indy 500 Fun Fact Challenge, go to the Fun Fact Challenge link at Indy500Coverage.com. If you're not sure of the answer, there's a handy research link to Inspire, which is Indiana's virtual library free to all Hoosiers, right on the contest page. So, who coined the phrase the Indianapolis 500 as the greatest spectacle in racing? Go to the Fun Fact Challenge link at Indy500Coverage.com. All right, we will be here until 7:15 taking your questions, hopefully of a nostalgic nature, about the Indianapolis 500 and the 500-mile race. And we've got Chris on the line. You're up next. Thanks for calling in.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon. I'm related to Howdy Wilcox.
Which one?
I was just going to say, not the 1919 winner, but the one who came in second in 1932.
Oh, yeah.
And yes, I am. My grandfather's uncle, or was my grandfather's uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, I have bits and pieces, kind of, you know, flashes here and there of stories about him and things like that. I knew that he came in second in 1932 and that he was around there for a while and he had diabetes and they wouldn't let him race. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about him so I can learn a little more about my family.
All right. Well, fine. I'll tell you what. If you want to call me at the museum, I knew that there were several relatives in town. I've met some, but apparently I haven't hooked up with you yet. But if you want to call me sometime, and I'll refer you to a magazine article that I wrote in Open Wheel a long time ago, about 1983 or somewhere in there, I think. But just to quickly do it, he was from here. He was not related to the Howdy Wilcox who won in 1919. That Howdy Wilcox came from Crawfordsville. This one was born in Indianapolis. Those in the other Howdy Wilcox family that felt that this young fellow, they suggested that his name was not Wilcox, but that he'd merely assumed the name of the 1919 winner in order to further his racing career. Well, he was born in 1907, and he was named Howard O. Wilcox at birth. Now, his mother's name was Johnson when he was going to school, but that's because she had remarried. The father had died, and I found this out a few years ago. The father had died when Howdy the Second, as the press called him, was quite young, and he was diabetic. So it was in the blood. It was handed down, if you like. So anyway, she married a fellow named Johnson. And so that's where there was some misunderstanding in the other family, that they thought that Howard Wilcox had made up the name. Well, Howdy Wilcox, the 1919 winner, was fatally injured in 1923, and it was just about the time that the other one was getting started in racing. It's possible that they never met. But I don't know. Maybe they did. But the thinking is that they probably never met. Well, anyway, the Howdy Wilcox II got going in dirt track racing, and he raced with pre 500. He raced with Wilbur Shaw, Louis Schneider, Billy Arnold, Shorty Cantlin, Dutch Bowman, and a number of others that all sort of grew up together, raced together. Bill Cummings was another one. They all raced against each other before they ever went to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. All right, his shot was 1932, the first time, and he drove the Lionhead Special, which was owned by Shorty Cantlin, who had been injured out west and had a broken leg and couldn't drive, and so he hired his friend, Howdy Wilcox II, to drive in the race. He ended up finishing second behind Fred Frame, and he also was second in the national championship. He drove the rest of the championship trail, as it was to later be known, but it was a short season, and I think they only had like maybe five races total. But he did fairly well in the others, and he did end up he ended up third in the national championship because Bob Carey was the point champion, and Indianapolis winner Fred Frame ended up second with Wilcox in third. Anyway, in 1933, he came back with a car that was owned by Joe Marks at the Gilmore Special. He qualified outside the second row, and I think he started fifth in '32, but anyway, that's immaterial. So he qualified for the outside of the second row, and then a couple of days before the race, there was an incident which took place in the there was a little lunch counter called Tom Beale's Diner, which was located half in the garage area and half on the outside of it. So anyway, it was basically where all the racers would hang out, and it was just a low sitting lunch counter with wooden stools. And so anyway, they Louis Schneider, who was all part of that group, had a sponsor named Edelweiss that made beer. And so anyway, they had some beer, and Howdy Wilcox II collapsed, and it immediately the friends realized what had happened, that he was diabetic, and so they rushed to get candy off of the counter and force it down his throat to get the candy into his body. Well, a doctor either witnessed it or heard about it, and the word got around that he had had an epileptic fit, which he had not. And so the doctor said that he couldn't run because he was, they didn't want him passing out while the race was on. So he was ruled that he couldn't run. Well, there was a huge uproar because Howdy Wilcox was very, very popular. And race morning, there was a petition presented that had been signed by all of the other drivers, which that year was 41 other people, because there was 42 starters in the 33 race, and it was turned down. Eventually, Eddie Rickenback had got involved, and he said, that he wasn't going to overrule the doctor, and that if they didn't, get in the cars and start in the next few minutes, that, there may not ever be another 500-mile race. Well, anyway, the thing got off about 15 minutes late, but there was another incident happening. In the meantime, they put in Maury Rose to substitute. Now, the thinking is that only took place just minutes before the start. Well, Maury Rose told me that he knew about it the day before. And he said that it was all arranged that he was going to drive, and they said, but the owner and Howdy Wilcox were just adamant about not giving up. Well, anyway, Maury Rose gets in the car, and then the people behind protested because he'd never been in a 500 before. He'd been there the year before and not qualified, and he'd been there this year and not qualified, and they said he shouldn't, we don't want to start behind this guy starting on the outside of the second row. So, And he'd won two championship races in 32. So they got around it by pushing the car all the way to the back and moved the outside. Instead of moving everybody up one, they moved the outside flank up one. So if you'd qualified ninth, you moved to sixth and so on and so forth. So Maury Rose started dead last, and he got up to fourth in about 50 laps before he dropped out. And anyway, in the meantime, a few days after the race, Howdy Wilcox II filed suit because of the fact that he did not have epilepsy. The suit, it finally went to trial at the Franklin Courthouse in 1935, right after the 500, June 35, 2 years after the incident that we're talking about. And every time I go down to Franklin, go by the courthouse, I'd look and see that thing. They had Wilbur Shaw testified, Billy DeVore testified, and I think Bill Cummings. But anyway, the jury ruled in favor of Howdy Wilcox, and he sued for $60,000, and I'm almost done here. He sued for $60,000. The jury awarded him $42,000. It was the Depression, and the thinking is that he probably received maybe $3,000 at most. And anyway, after the war, he never raced again. He became a starter. He was involved in several racing associations, one of particular interest, but rather than go into that, he was flagging a race at Converse, Indiana late 1946, and he was hit by a car while he was standing on the track flagging the race. Anyway, Chris, give me a call sometime, preferably after the race, and I'll tell you a lot more. Anyway, we do have to take a break here, so Mark, Paul, Scott, thank you for your patience. Hang on. We'll get to you when we return. Right after this, you're listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. Back with the talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. We'll be here for another 30 minutes. We're going until 7:15 this evening, so give us a call. 239-1070 is the number, 239-1070. And Mark, you're up next. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Donald.
Yes, sir. How are you?
Hi, this is Mark, your personal photographer. How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm on my way back to Detroit, and first of all, I want to make a comment that I enjoy your passion for history. And when you meet all of these racing personalities, you're just like a little kid that's still excited about it, and I appreciate that. So
okay, thanks.
Okay, now on to my historical question. The rumble strips were put on the track in order to keep the cars from going down too low on the track, and I remember they actually ended up causing more trouble than they were worth. What year were those rumble strips installed, and how long did they last?
Oh, golly. I remember Fittipaldi got into them in 1994, and I don't remember when they were first around. I know Lou Palmer was still doing the daily reports, and you would hear like this high whine as somebody got into them, and they took several different forms. They would put them in for the stock car race and then take them out. So I really can't answer your question. I think they were in and out a couple of times, so they did take different forms. So when they were first there, I can't give you a year.
Okay.
All right. Sorry.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. And let's go to Paul, and maybe we can answer this one. Good evening, Paul. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Donald. It's Paul from Racine.
Hey,
good to
Paul.
Talk to you.
Hi, Paul.
How are you? Just a real brief footnote to the Fittipaldi orange juice thing.
Yeah.
The following week, I was at Milwaukee, and, of course, Wisconsin's the dairy state. I was at the Penske merchandise trailer outside of Turn 4 at the end of the day on Saturday, and he drove up with his entourage in his car, and I saw in his vehicle a inflatable cow.
Yeah.
So I think definitely he was getting the business for that. We all know what happened in 94 and 95, so, yeah, you don't want to mess with the traditions of Indy. Donald, could you talk about Teddy Mayer?
Yes, Teddy Mayer passed away, about a year ago, I think. He was an American, and I think most people didn't realize that. His background was law. He was from a pretty well-to-do family, Scranton, Pennsylvania, or he was from Pennsylvania. And I think that his uncle was the governor of the state for a while. But anyway, he and his brother went to England. Timmy was the driver, and Teddy was sort of like the business manager type. Tim Mayer was fatally injured in early 64 at the Tasman Series. And Teddy became involved with another American, Tyler Alexander, in Team McLaren. They were Bruce McLaren associates, in fact, helped form the original team. And so after Bruce McLaren was fatally injured, the date was June the 2nd of 1970, then Teddy Mayer and Tyler pretty much took over the company in conjunction with Bruce McLaren's widow. First came here to the Speedway in 1970. In the meantime, I mean, Bruce McLaren was still alive at the time they came the first time. And, of course, McLaren famously just dominated the Can-Am series. After Bruce was gone, when they came back in 71, Teddy Mayer was sort of like the team manager. And Peter Revson was on the pole and finished second. And then all of the great McLaren years there, with Rutherford winning the race in 74 and 76. And they did, as Teddy called it, doing the double, because not only did they win the 500, they won the world championships the same year. When Rutherford won the 500, Emerson Fittipaldi won his second world championship, having come over from Lotus. And then in 76, when Rutherford won the second 500, which was rain shortened, James Hunt was the world champion. At some point in 82 or 83 or somewhere in there, there was big upheaval with Team McLaren, and they were ousted. Ron Dennis that was brought in to run the team, and Teddy and Tyler were out of it. Well, in 1984, and this is kind of trivia, there was a Mayer Motor Racing that came here, and the drivers, there's a kind of an involved story about how the driver lineup was arrived at, but it ended up being Tom Sneva and Howdy Holmes, and they started 1-2. And Howdy Holmes was still running at the end of the race. Tom Sneva was running second and would have made a terrific battle for the finish with Rick Mears, and we were robbed of that battle because he broke a half shaft under the yellow with, I think it was like 168 laps. So anyway, they never came back. So is this trivia where it was a team that came to the Speedway, sat 1-2 on the grid, and never came back. Anyway, after that, Teddy Mayer was involved with Carl Haas for a while with the Formula One team, the Beatrice Formula One team with Alan Jones. And then he worked for Penske for several years and had retired quite recently, but I think he might have still been like a consultant with Penske. But anyway, he was rather an odd sort. He was a little tiny fellow, and I don't know. I think a lot of people had no idea that he was American. Anyway, Paul, thanks very much indeed. Have a good trip back to Milwaukee, and we appreciate your support on this program. We have about a little over 20 minutes left. Scott, you hang in there. Give us a call, 239-1070. We'll be back and take more calls on the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. We're back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan, and we got plenty of callers hanging on. Let's go to Scott. Good evening. Thanks for calling. Hello,
yes,
Scott.
Yes, sir, Mr. Davidson. I'd like to ask you a couple of questions. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. I grew up in Speedway as a child, and I went to the race, but Sweet Savage and Salt Walter, were those the same incidents, or were they different? And a different question I want to ask you about is Jim Herdebees. Was he the last person to have a front-engine car?
Okay, the answer to the second part is yes. And the last time that he was on the track was 1979. He was entered in 80, but he wasn't on the track. But 79, he actually did practice. I don't think he was very serious about it. Swede Savage and Salt Walther were separate accidents, but the same year. The Salt Walther accident was at the start of the original start on the first day, which was Monday, May 28th of 73, and then we ran into a couple of days of rain. The Swede Savage accident took place on May the 30th, the day where the race actually was held, even though it didn't run to completion, but it got to 133 laps, and Gordon Johncock was declared the winner. Maybe just a little bit of trivia is the fact that obviously Salt Walther was a nickname, and Swede Savage was a nickname. Their first names were the same. They were both David was their given name. Okay?
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much indeed for the call. Back to the phones, and Steve, you're up next.
Yeah, David?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Donald, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Yeah, I had a brother-in-law in 61 that drove in the 500. His name was A.J. Shepard.
Oh, yeah.
And they had a wreck that year and everything, but I know they used to run sprint cars out in California in the wintertime,
and
they would come back to Indy in the summer, and he was quite a bit older than me.
Mm-hmm.
But he qualified 11th as a rookie, and he was pretty good, and he was in a wreck, supposedly, that year at the Hoosier 100 and ended his career.
Yep.
And
want me to talk about him?
Yeah, I sure do.
Okay. 61 was the only 500 start that he had. He'd raced with CRA out west, as you suggested. I think he lived in Gardena for a while. And then he came back to the Midwest and ran IMCA sprint cars. And in 1960, he was third in IMCA points. And then he joined USAC. and drove in the 61-500 for Ernie Roos with the Travelon Trailer Special. He had actually, I don't think he qualified 11th. I don't remember what the starting position was, but he was running 11th at the time that there was an accident took place. Boy, we talk a lot about accidents the last few days. Accident took place on the main straightaway that involved five cars. Three of the drivers were from Arizona. There's a little trivia there. Jack Turner, poor Jack Turner, got upside down. He'd just gone to second place. Bill Cheeseburg, Roger McCluskey, and Don Davis were the other drivers that were involved. And A.J. Shepard was actually, what happened was Don Davis had hit the wall. I don't know if he blew a tire and hit the wall, but anyway, he did hit the wall and came spinning down the straightaway, but quite a bit north of the start finish line. Car came to rest in the middle of the track, and the thinking was that he must have been dazed because he got out and walked quite leisurely across the track, and A.J. Shepard was coming down side by side with Bill Cheeseburg, and he just momentarily tapped the brakes, and he went around one side of Don Davis's car, and just as Don Davis was hopping over the wall, missed him. Bill Cheeseburg was going around the other side, but in the meantime, A.J. was turning to the sliding to the right, and he ended up T-boning Bill Cheeseburg, and then it started off the accident that I just referred to that ended up with Jack Turner getting upside down. Anyway, later that summer, A.J. Shepard had a great weekend when he started on the outside of the front row for the Springfield 100 on dirt and finished fourth. And then the next day, with the same car, ran to sixth place at the Milwaukee 200, which was on pavement. The accident at the fairgrounds that you referred to, he was qualifying for the Hoosier 100, and apparently he was trying to go through the first turn flat. He took the green flag and went into turn one, got high, and then went flipped completely over the fence. They didn't have a bunch of catch fence in those days. He flipped end over end and then hit the one of the horse barns that was, I think they're still there. They are still there. Anyway, that was the end of his career. He did come back and ran in like super modifieds, but he never was able to run USAC again. But anyway, yeah, A.J. Shepard has a brother, Don Shepard, who I still see, and I could talk about him as well because he had his career, but not as a driver. But anyway, we thank you very much indeed. And I think we're going to take a break right here as we're coming up to 6:58. We will be here until 7:15. Bill, Mike, hang on. We'll take a break, and we'll be right back. We are back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley. We will be here for all of this next week. We'll be on from, actually on as far as 1070 The Fan, we'll be on from 6 until 8, Monday through Thursday at 7 o'clock. We hook up with Network Indiana. And then on Friday, we do not do the 6 to 7 show because of the heavyweights, but we will be here from 7 till 8. And then that will be it for the season, or at least until the next event. On Saturday night, we do not do a show, but Mike Sarawick will have his 13th annual Night Before the Race party. And he will play the broadcast from 1968 and 1978, and then also he will have some interviews that he's done with people in fairly recent days that were connected with those two events. Anyway, we will be here for about another 12 minutes or so. So let's go back to the phones. And Bill, good evening. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you for taking my call, Donald. Two questions. Did John Andretti set a record for most times bumped today? And then, if I remember right, it hasn't been too many years ago that he came up, after he'd gone to NASCAR, came up and helped more than one driver set up their car and make the race. And then AJ gave him a car of his to qualify right at the end of qualifications. Could you talk about that?
Okay, well, it was, I think that was 1993, and I do not, he actually took a car out that was Derek Walker, and I'm afraid I'm hazy as to who the driver was, but test hopping was pretty much of a thing of the past in those days, but he did get in and drive laps for somebody, but it was Derek Walker's car, and then Foyt gave him a car to drive, and he was teammate to Robbie Gordon in 93, and then he came back when the car was black and Copenhagen colors, and then in 94, he had the arrangement with Jonathan Bird, and it was still Foyt, but the car was painted red. But anyway, that was John did the. In fact, he did keep. It was a squeaker, but he did keep a record intact because he has never not qualified for the 500. He was here 88 through 94 and qualified each year, and had a good run going. In 91, he was fifth. In 92, he was eighth, and then 93, 94, he was 10th. And then he did not come back as an entered driver until 2007. And so it was looking a little dodgy at the last minute, but he did get it in. And so he has never not qualified for the 500 in a year in which he tried. Bill, are you still there?
Yes.
All right. Was there another part to your question that I didn't get to?
Well, that was it.
That was it. Okay.
Yep.
All right, then.
Thank you.
All right, we thank you very much for calling in. And, Mike, you're up next.
Hey, Donald. I spoke to you yesterday. I'm the Russo kid.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, I wonder if you could tell our fans about the Jigger Saroy debacle. And then when you're done with that, I was always curious whatever happened to old Rick Muther with the Blatt Special. Went up on his two wheels.
Oh, well, do I really have to do the first part?
Yeah, that was major screw-up.
No, not really.
No, I guess it was.
No,
it was.
But I wish they wouldn't have done it. That, you know what? I wish 1969, the first day, had just been washed out completely. I hated the teasers, and there was a situation that was set up that day. And by golly, it's 40 years later, and it won't go away. All right. It rained on the first qualifying day, and they finally got the track dried, but it was overcast, and there was rain hanging in the air. And they had a draw in those days, but they didn't have a protection for each person being guaranteed one time through. And Jigger drew the number one position. So when they finally got the track dried, they'd had the mandatory 30-minute practice session. Jigger goes off the line. I think it was like 20 to 2. He takes the three warm-up laps, raises his hand, and then proceeds to do three laps at 161.4 average, I think, and then was coming around for what would be the checkered flag. And in those days, you only got one checkered flag. You got up to three attempts, but only one checkered flag. And apparently the crew were going to let him go and take the time. And at the last moment, Myron Caves, who was the car owner, grabbed the yellow flag, waved it, and that aborted the run. So Jigger comes in. The next car goes out was Arnie Knepper, and I think he took maybe one or two warm-ups. And then the yellow came on because it was sprinkling with rain. Knepper comes in, and it ended up raining out the rest of the day. And, in fact, it rained out the rest of the weekend. So there were no qualifiers. It was one incomplete attempt. And everybody from that point on said if Jigger had gone ahead and finished the fourth lap, he would have been on the pole. And could the pole car be bumped? And I don't think we've had that one mercifully for like a couple of years now. But the answer is yes. And it was a lot easier to do in those days than it would be now. But anyway, it didn't matter because he didn't complete the run. Well, anyway, they went ahead on the second weekend and filled the whole field. But there was an interesting thing going on the last day where people were waving off 163. And remember that Jigger's three-lap average was 161.4, and nobody wanted to be the slowest. And then there were still spots open when Jerry Grant went out on a practice run with about 45 minutes to go, or maybe just a little bit more than that, and an oil line came adrift, oil down the track, And by the time they got the track cleared, there was only about 30 minutes to go. There were spots open, and it was a case of just going the four laps, and you could just make the show. And in fact, Peter Revson was the last qualifier, and he had a four-lap average at 160 point something. And everybody said, look, you know, Jigger could have made it because he was running 161. But I had this theory that had Jigger gone ahead and completed the run, it wouldn't have held up because the other people would have had something to aim for. Nobody wanted to be the slowest. And so could the pole car be bumped? Yes. But then the other thing I say is that qualifications are not over until they're over. And the way the system was in those days, you were merely posting your time and speed, and you'd have to wait and see that it held up or not. And it was just like when you play golf, and you can't have everybody qualifying at the same time. And when you're playing golf, and I don't know a great deal about it, but I think you go in fours or twos or something like that, but you're not all playing at the same time. And so as the players coming in, you know, the scores, your final score doesn't count until you've already come in. And so just the same there, if Jigger had gone ahead and taken the four laps and been on the pole temporarily, I do believe that he would have been bumped out. I don't know if that makes any sense or not, and I hope I don't get that question again this month, because it's just, I've done it so many times. I don't think we've had it this season, but now, Scott, you can check that one off. I think we've had all of our favorites. Anyway, Mike, you do be sure and give me a call sometime, preferably after the race, and we'll talk to you about your dad. All right, let's go back to the phones, and Dan, you're next.
Hello, Donald. My daughter Abby's great-grandpa was one of the last 11 employees of Studebaker.
Yes.
In South Bend. I was wondering if you'd give her some information about Studebaker and what her grandpa might have done.
All right. Well, Studebaker did have a team in 1932, and when the specifications were changed for 1930 and announced in January 29, by the way, this was not anything to do with the Wall Street crash, although it's often credited as being so. A new set of rules were drawn up in the summer of 28 and went into, they were announced in January 29 that in 1930 the specs would be changed to encourage the manufacturers to come back. Well, in 1930, Studebaker engineers wanted their company to come down and enter cars in the 500. The company didn't want to do it, so five or six engineers did it on their own. The car was called the Rumpthe Special, O-R-O-M-T-H-E, and that was actually the initials of the six engineers that entered the car. And a driver named J.C. McDonald was the driver. And then in 31, George Hunt, who was the H of Rumpthe, entered a car, and it was called the there was also the Bill Richards Special. I'm sorry, getting a little bit confused in my own mind now. But anyway, Tony Gallotta in the Hunt Special with the Studebaker engine. It was a car built by Rigling and Henning, and he was running second and would have taken the lead after Billy Arnold crashed and leading. And Tony Gallotta was the next up, and he was a couple of laps down. But if he had kept running, he would have taken over the lead. But he actually crashed before he could take the lead. Well, anyway, that car was... there were three others built just like it. No, four others were built just like it. And so in 1932, Studebaker finally came in with an official team, Rigling and Henning Bodies, and Studebaker President Stock Block Engines. And all five qualified. Cliff Brazier finished third. Zeke Meyer was sixth. And two of the cars dropped out with a wheel bearing problem. Well, the following year they came back. One of the cars was as it appeared in 32. The other four had streamlined bodies put on them, which Cliff Brazier said ruined the cars. And Tony Gallotta finished seventh for the best finish. They all went the 200 laps, and they finished seventh, ninth, tenth, 11th, and 12th. And then also there was a Studebaker engine car that Russ Snowberger ran. That wasn't a factory entry, but actually a Studebaker-powered car started on the pole in 1931. And Studebaker's continued to run. The last one was in 1937. Louis Tomei finished 10th with one of the 1932 cars. It was called the Sobernight Plastic Special. And Zeke Meyer with a Boyle Special that had a Studebaker engine finished 9th in 1936. Anyway, thanks for the call. We've got about a minute and a half left, and we do have Marilyn hanging on. We wanted to try and get to everybody. So, Marilyn, you've got about a minute. What can we do for you?
Oh, Donald, I have a really fast, silly question. But
okay, good.
What's the farthest back starting position that anyone has won the race from?
Oh, okay, I can tell you that one. It's 28th. And that was Ray Haroon in 1911 and then Louis Meyer in 1936. Since the war, it's been Johnny Rutherford started 25th in 1974 and went on to win the race. And then another one that was close was Al Unser Sr., who I said earlier started 22nd. It was actually 20th in 1987. But anyway, the record is 28th. Anyway, we just got a few moments to go, and so thank you, Marilyn. I guess we were able to get everybody in, maybe not answer the questions to completion, but we did want to get as many as we possibly could. Our thanks to Matt Taylor for being back at the studio and taking your calls when you call in and then sending them out here. And then Scott Johnston, as ever, is the on-site producer. That's all the time that we have for. We'll be back tomorrow night at 6 o'clock with the talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. Good night, everybody.